We'll now commence class number two, being led by our brother Roger Lewis. The overall title of this weekend is From Eden Lost to Eden Restored. And the second class is The Mysterious Tale of Two Temples. Why does the spirit of Nimrod roam St. John Lateran's? With that, let's give our full attention to Brother Roger.
Well, thank you again, Brother Chairman. I hope that the title of this second session might intrigue you in terms of a follow-on perhaps from the first. The Mysterious Tale of Two Temples. Why does the spirit of Nimrod roam St. John Lateran's? Well, actually, it's prompted by, again, an alternative view of prophecy. If you come to the second of Thessalonians, which we did mention in our first study. Remember how we mentioned that the last controversy between the seed of the serpent champion and the seed of the woman champion will come down to the second of Thessalonians chapter 2 and to the overthrow of the man of sin by our Lord Jesus Christ. So our particular title and our particular subject this time is really based on 2 Thessalonians when it says this in verse 4 of chapter 2. It says that the man of sin will oppose and exalt himself above all that's called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And one of the alternative views that I've heard propounded on that subject in the Brotherhood is, well, the temple of God was in Jerusalem, and therefore the temple of God of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 needs to be in Jerusalem, and therefore the man of sin is not going to be seen until there's a temple in Jerusalem. So therefore the Jews have to rebuild a temple in Jerusalem so the man of God can come and sit in the temple and be revealed as the man of sin in that temple, because the temple of God's always been in Jerusalem. And after all, how could you possibly say that the temple of God is St. Peter's in the Vatican? So that's the thesis. That's the alternative view. And therefore, the man of sin is not going to be seen until that temple's rebuilt in Jerusalem, presumably at the time of the end. A temple in Jerusalem, the temple of God. That's where the man of sin's got to sit. And you see, brothers and sisters, what happens is that when you haven't got a framework of Bible prophecy to benchmark ideas against and with, well, you think, well, maybe that sounds reasonable. Perhaps that is right. Maybe there is a latter-day temple yet to be built in fulfillment of Bible prophecy. And what I hope to show in this study, therefore, is how that once we've got a framework of Bible prophecy, we've got a basis for analysing whether such ideas are in fact scripturally sound. We've got to have a framework for being able to do that. Now, if you come back to the book of Genesis again, but this time to chapter 9, I want to draw your attention to an interesting prophecy. The book of Genesis and chapter 9 was actually the prophecy of Noah concerning his sons. And I just want to draw attention to one statement that Noah makes. Clearly, by the way, the prophecy of Noah concerning his sons was very much about the destiny of his three boys down through time and the races that sprang from them. And he says this in verse 26 of Genesis chapter 9. He said, "Blessed be Yahweh Elohim of Shem." Now, you notice what it says, verse 25. "Cursed be Canaan," that's of the line of Ham. Verse 27, "God shall enlarge Japheth." But of Shem it says, verse 26, he doesn't say, "Blessed be Shem." Did you notice that? He says, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem." Ah, so what we're being told right from the beginning is that Shem, in some way, is in covenant relationship with God. And if one blesses Yahweh Elohim of Shem, well then Shem's own blessedness stands in relationship to the fact that he's in covenant relationship with God, unlike the two other boys. And the proof of that is verse 27. God shall enlarge Japheth, and so he was, brothers and sisters, as we shall see in our subsequent studies. And yet for all of that it says, verse 27, he, Japheth, shall dwell in the tents of Shem. Now you see, I think that's a prophecy. I think what Genesis 9 was saying is that Japheth could only come to God through the tent of Shem. Because the tent of Shem was where the true worship of the seed of the woman was practiced. And only in the tent of Shem was there access to God. And both those of the line of Ham and those of the line of Japheth could only worship God in spirit and in truth if they found him by coming into the tabernacle of Shem. Now, why that's interesting is what Genesis chapter 11 says in verse 1. So what we're doing now is this. Before I start mentioning that, let's just remind ourselves of how the story began in our last session. So we said there's one story down through time, the seed of the woman versus the seed of the serpent. And we also said that that was actually manifested in subsequent phases. There was a Babylon and there was an Israel, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, a Babylon phase 1 and a Babylon phase 2. And so we saw all of that, two rival systems, you see. And now, what we're suggesting is this, as this new story unfolds, is that not only were there two rival systems, but I'm going to suggest to you that right from the very beginning of time, there were two rival temples, or places of worship. And the first one belongs to the seed of the woman, Genesis 9. You can only access God through the tabernacle of Shem. Now you see what happens, Genesis 11, verse 1. It says, and the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, and let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, and let us build us a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Now, let's read verse 4 again, shall we? Because do you remember that good Bible study is always based on good Bible reading? So read verse 4 again. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. See the focus. This is the seed of the serpent. Let us make us. Let us build us. That's the first thing. And by the way, you see the two key words? Let us build a city, and let us make a name. And you know, one of the marvelous things about the book of Hebrews, when it talks about the faith of Abraham, that he came out into a place, not knowing whithersoever he went, but he did so because of the principle of faith. For, it says of Abraham in Genesis chapter 11, for he looked for a city whose builder, let us build, and whose maker, let us make, is God, says Hebrews 11. And Abraham, as part of the seed of the woman community, was looking for that city of whom the maker and the builder was God, not men. He wanted to be associated with a different order of things and with the temple of worship, the place of worship that God provided amongst the seed of the woman. But this is the seed of the serpent in Genesis 11, verse 4. And they said, no, in effect, you know what they said, verse 4? They said, let us make us a name. Now, you might know that in the Hebrew, the word name is Shem. Let us make us our own Shem. And not only our own Shem, but our own tent of worship. Thank you very much. Verse 4, let us build us not just a city, but a tower. And that tower was the first rival temple. It was a tower for the practicing of the early Babylonish rites. And really what the seed of the serpent is saying in Genesis chapter 11 is, we repudiate what Noah has said. We do not accept the name of Shem. We do not accept the tent of worship as belonging to Shem. We want our own Shem and our own tent and our own rival system from the beginning. Not the tents of Shem for us. We will have our own meeting place of worship. And that word tower in Genesis 11 verse 4 has relation to the ziggurat that was built in Babylon from the earliest time. In fact, the Babylonish records tell us that it was begun by Nimrod's father and finished by Nimrod himself. Nimrod built it. This very tower in Genesis chapter 11. It was, by the way, a mystical building. It was 92 metres long and 92 metres wide and 92 metres high. It was built according to mystical numbers. And when one looked at this particular ziggurat, which had the name of Temenenki, it had seven levels. And if you came walking up to a Temenenki, at the bottom you would see these two giant gates at the first level of the tower. And then if you lifted your eyes above those, you'd see another level, and on that next level was a set of gates. And if you lifted your eyes further, there was another set of gates above the second gates, and so on, to the third, and to the fourth, and to the fifth, and to the sixth, and to the seventh. And you suddenly realized, as you looked at this tower in Babylon, that why this was the gateway to the gods, the very gate to heaven itself, where the gods might be found and worshipped. And in fact, the Sumerian name Temenenki means literally the house of the foundation of heaven on earth. This was a temple in which Nimrod first practiced the Babylonish religion. It was from this earliest time that the sign of the zodiac was born and the horoscopes of the Babylonians were begun. And at the very top of the temple was a room, a chamber, right at the top of that ziggurat. And into that chamber, brothers and sisters, only the high priest could go. And his consort queen. And the Babylonian ritual forbade anyone else to enter that top temple, but the very high priest himself and his consort. And it was the beginning of the rival system of religion, a system dedicated to the thinking and practice of the seed of the serpent. Now, think about this, brothers and sisters. We're only at Genesis chapter 10, chapter 11. We're very, very early on in the history of the world, and yet the seed of the serpent's already got their own rival temple, a city and a tower. And in that ziggurat, there's a king priest by name of Nimrod, who's the founder of that rival system. When we come to Genesis chapter 14, do you remember we looked at this before, but have a look at it again now in the context of the other side of the line, the seed of the woman. Because, strange to say, Genesis 14 simply says this, verse 18, "And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God." So he was a king, verse 18, and he was a priest. So we've got a king priest in Babylon, in the ziggurat, and we've got a king priest in Salem. But do you notice? It doesn't mention any temple in Genesis 14. Do you notice that? But if it was Shem, he wasn't living in a temple, was he? He wasn't practicing in a tower. Where was Shem? Shem was in just a tabernacle. Now that humble tabernacle over which Shem presided was the place of worship for the seed of the woman and through whom alone God could be accessed. Do you know, brothers and sisters, there's only one other place in the Bible where that word Salem is mentioned. Actually, does anyone know where it is? The only other place where Salem is mentioned. Actually, I should really recover myself. The only other chronological episode where Salem is mentioned. Ooh, I almost fell into a trap. So I'm not thinking of Hebrews, I'm thinking of Psalm 76, verse 2, the only other place in the Bible where Salem's mentioned. And you might just like to see that, because it's in the days of Hezekiah, when Sennacherib came down, like a great champion of the seed of the serpent against Hezekiah of the seed of the woman. The two rivals were joined in conflict. Psalm 76 says, verse 1, in Judah is God known, his name is great in Israel. In Salem also is his tabernacle. Ah, that's the tent of Shem. That's the man who lives in Salem. That's Melchizedek. That's the other priestly system. That's the temple, the initial temple of the seed of the woman in Salem, presided over by none other than Melchizedek. And so now we've got a king priest in Babylon, and we've got a king priest in Salem. One is in a tower, the other is in a temple, but they're rivals, brothers and sisters, and the one place of worship excites the enmity and hostility of the other. And that really brings us to the second of Chronicles chapter 36, because now you might see the significance of the unfolding of this story. It's like those red Mercedes. When you've got a framework, all sorts of other things start to pop up. And it's amazing, brothers and sisters, what you see when you finally see. Now, you see what it says in 2 Chronicles 36, verse 14. See if this is not part of this ancient rivalry between the two temples. Moreover, verse 14, all the chief of the priests and the people transgressed very much after all the abominations of the heathen and polluted the house of Yahweh, which he'd hallowed in Jerusalem. And Yahweh, Elohim of their fathers, sent to them by his messengers, rising up betimes and sending, because he had compassion. But they mocked the messengers. And so verse 17 says, therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees, who slew their young men with the sword. Where? In the house of their sanctuary. And had no compassion upon young men or maiden, old man, or him that stooped for age. He gave them all into his hand, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and all the treasures of the house of Yahweh, and the treasures of the king and his princes, all these he brought to Babylon, and they burned the house of God. They burned it with fire, brothers and sisters. And the champion, Nebuchadnezzar, as the champion of the temple in Babylon, of the rival seed of the serpent, came down to Salem and burned the temple of God with fire and slew those remnants of the seed of the woman and carried those that were left forth into captivity. And that really brings us to Daniel chapter 1. And to the outworking of that story. Because when Nebuchadnezzar came down and burned the house of God with fire, by the way, you might like to remember that, he burned the house of God with fire. Just remember that for later on. So Daniel 1 verse 1 says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. Ooh, can you feel the two temples here, brothers and sisters? He brought the vessels up from the house of God that was in Jerusalem. And where did he bring them? He brought them into the house of his God. Can you feel the two temples and the two seeds there in conflict? And by the way, where was the temple of his God? The temple of Nebuchadnezzar's God. Where was that temple? Why, it says. Why, verse 2, it was in the land of Shinar. Ah, that takes us all the way back to Genesis chapter 11, that they journeyed to the land of Shinar and said, let us build us a tower in this place. And do you know what's really interesting, brothers and sisters? That very temple that Nebuchadnezzar brought those vessels back to in Daniel chapter 1 was the same building that Nimrod built. Still there. The very same building. The very same temple as Genesis chapter 11. Still there, but now Nebuchadnezzar is in fact the champion of that system. And there's a tremendous continuum down through time, you see, in this story. Can we look at Daniel chapter 5? I've always thought this was interesting. Daniel chapter 5. Have you ever stopped to think about the significance of the opening verses of Daniel chapter 5? Well, it says this, verse 1. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before 1,000. And Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the gold and silver vessels which his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple that was in Jerusalem, that the king and the princes and his wives and his concubines might drink therein. And then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king and his princes and his wives and his concubines drank in them. And they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver and of brass and of iron and of wood and of stone. You ever stop to think about this, brothers and sisters? The king of Babylon, do you know that the empire of Babylon was such a mighty dominion that had conquered surrounding nations, and they had innumerable treasures, untold wealth, the spectacle of the booty of the Babylonian conquests. And yet the one thing that Belshazzar asked to have brought forth as the symbol of Babylonish conquest was the vessels of the house of God in Jerusalem. Oh, isn't that interesting? And he said, I want to drink Babylonish wine out of those vessels as the symbol of the triumph of my temple over the temple of the seed of the woman. Isn't that interesting, brothers and sisters? And by the way, lest you should think that that's not so, and that I've imagined that rivalry, do you know that when Belshazzar drank out of those vessels, he sealed his doom? Because those vessels were God's vessels, and they did belong to God's house. And God would never forget that, and for that matter, God would not forgive that. In fact, come to Ezra chapter 5, and let me show you how that particular story worked. Because, of course, we know that, by the way, on the very night that Belshazzar drank out of those vessels, his kingdom was forfeit and the king himself was slain. But do you see what Ezra says in Ezra chapter 5 concerning the vessels that he had drunk out of on that occasion of the great feast he made to his lords in Babylon on that fateful night? Ezra 5 says, verse 12, but after that our fathers had provoked the God of heaven unto wrath, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed this house and carried the people away into Babylon. But in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Babylon, the same king Cyrus did make a decree to build this house of God. Vessels also of gold and silver of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that was in Jerusalem, brought them into the temple of Babylon. These did Cyrus the king take out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered unto one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he'd made governor. He said unto him, take these vessels, go carry them into the temple that's in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be builded in his place. Did you see the rivalry, brothers and sisters? Did you feel the rivalry between the two temples? Read it again. The vessels also of gold and silver of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that was in Jerusalem and brought them into the temple of Babylon, those did Cyrus the king take out of the temple of Babylon and delivered them unto Sheshbazzar, and said, take these vessels and carry them into the temple at Jerusalem. I think there's a rivalry between those two temples, don't you? It's all part of the continuum that began in Genesis 9, Genesis 10, Genesis 11, when the seed of the serpent said, we don't want the name or the tabernacle of Shem as the basis of worship, we'll make our own. And that rivalry's been there ever since, has it not? The rivalry between two ways, two leaders, two king priests, and now even two temples. And by the way, that actually is consistent with this passage here in Jeremiah chapter 51. Because in Jeremiah 51, which talks about the overthrow of the Babylonish system, it says this, just one little phrase really, but how significant in the context of our study. When it says this, Jeremiah 51 and verse 11, make bright the arrows, gather the shields. Yahweh hath raised up the spirit of the king of the Medes. For his device is against Babylon to destroy it, because it is the vengeance of Yahweh. The vengeance of his temple, it says. The vengeance of God's temple. That's the way God himself sees it. It's time for the vengeance of my temple. And what we're being told in Jeremiah chapter 51 is that God takes everything into account. And when Nebuchadnezzar burned the house of God with fire, God remembered that. And when the vessels of Yahweh's house were taken forth by Belshazzar to be drunk therein, God remembered that. And in the fullness of time, of course, everything would be held to account by God. And in fact, one day, that temple in Babylon was visited in judgment by God himself. And that really brings us to the prophecy of Zechariah in chapter 5, which is a very interesting passage for purposes of our session this morning. Zechariah chapter 5 has this to say about the temple in Babylon. Zechariah chapter 5. Verse 5. The angel that talked with me went forth and said unto me, lift up now thine eyes and see what is this that goeth forth. And he said, I said rather, what is it? And he said, this is an ephah that goeth forth. And he said, moreover, this is their resemblance throughout all the earth. Now, you see that word resemblance? In the Revised Standard Version, it translates that word as iniquity. And it comes, by the way, from the Septuagint that translates it as sin. This is their iniquity through all the earth. Now, you might just like to colour that word or highlight that word or pencil it or something. The word iniquity in verse 6, the word resemblance. This is their iniquity through all the earth. And verse 7 says, and behold, there was lifted up a talent of lead, and, says the prophet in surprise, and there's a woman. And not only that, but he says, there's a woman that sitteth in the midst of the ephah. Did you notice that? The word sitteth. She's sitting, he says. Funny that. I wonder why the prophet noticed that. She's sitting. Almost as if that was an occasion of importance to note. The woman sits. Remember that, brothers and sisters. Now verse 8. And he said, he looked at this woman and he said, oh, he said, this is wickedness. He looked at that woman and what she represented, and the statement that was brought forth is, this is nothing other than wickedness. And the Revised Version says, verse 8, and he cast her into the midst of the ephah and cast the weight of lead upon the mouth thereof. And I lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, there came two women, and the wind was in their wings, for they had wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the ephah between the earth and heaven. And I said to the angel that talked with me, whither do these bear the ephah? And he said unto me, and I'm reading from the Revised Standard Version, why, he said, to build her an house in the land of Shinar, and she shall be established and set there upon her own base, said the prophet. Now, what did the prophet mean in Zechariah chapter 5? Well, I'll tell you what's interesting. This prophecy comes to the prophet around about BC 510. And Babylon as a city had fallen to the Medes and Persians already about 30 years before in BC 539. But the Tower of Babel was still there. And it was going to last until BC 323. By the way, can you remember the king that came into the city of Babylon in the very year that the last high priest left? Who was the king? Alexander. What was the year? BC 333. Well, what happened was this. 10 years later, Alexander said, I'm of a mind to rebuild this ziggurat in Babylon. I think what we'll do is we'll rebuild it again. After all, it's a very significant tower. It goes all the way back to somebody called Nimrod. And so Alexander said that he would rebuild the temple in Babylon. He said, now, if we're going to really do a good job of this, what we need to do is let's clear the place first. So what he did is he took apart what was left, stone by stone and brick by brick, and he cleared the whole of that plain where the Tower of Babylon had once stood. So there was simply the outline of the old temple. In fact, you can actually see a satellite picture of that today. A satellite passing over will even today show you the remains of the Tower of Babel that goes all the way back in time. But the trouble is that after he'd cleared the platform, Alexander died. And they never did rebuild the temple. It was gone completely, absolutely destroyed. And they never built another one. Well, at least not there. And yet Zechariah 5 said that the woman was being transported so that she might have a house built for her, a little house in which she might live. The temple where the woman lives, whose name is called Wickedness. And where was that house to be built for the woman? Why, says verse 11, in the land of Shinar. Well, I can tell you, brothers and sisters, that that wasn't Babylon of old. No, this was a new Shinar. And this prophecy is about the building of a new home, a new temple, in the mystical land of Shinar, where the woman whose name is Wickedness might dwell in that place and be seen. And that's interesting, because that now, finally, brings us to the 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Now, you might have thought, that's a very long-winded introduction to 2 Thessalonians 2. But come and have a look now and see how that framework has been ever so helpful in making sense of the prophecy, and realizing that it's part of a continuum of a story that's been unfolding down through time. So now let's read the words of Thessalonians in the light of the story of that rival temple that's always been in existence between the two seas. So 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 says, verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means. For that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed. There's going to be a falling away, and the man of sin shall be revealed. By the way, the word falling away in verse 3, anyone know what the word is in the Greek? Apostasia. The word for apostasy. Do you know that in the Greek parchments, that word apostasia in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 3 is used for a rebellion. It's used of one who rebels. And of course, you know what Nimrod's name means, don't you? Nimrod's name means, we will rebel. See, Nimrod's the first great rebel. And the man of sin, in a sense, is the last great rebel. And this last rebellion, this last falling away, will reveal the man of sin, who's none other than Nimrod, under another name, but mantled with the same Babylonish spirit, the last rebellion. And this is what it says, verse 4. He opposes and exalts himself above all that's called God or that is worshipped, so that he is God sitteth. Do you remember what it said about the woman? She sits. What does it say about this man? He sits. In fact, the Greek's very explicit. He takes his seat, says the Greek, as if somehow it's important for us to know that. This man sits down on a seat. You must know that, he says. It's an identifying mark of the man of sin. And not only that, but verse 7 is going to go on and say, the mystery of iniquity doth already work. And when they see the woman with the ephah in Zechariah chapter 5, it says, this is their iniquity in all the earth. And Thessalonians says, that mystery of iniquity is now already at work. And by the way, when the man or the angel saw the woman, what did he say? He looked at her and he said, oh, he said, this is, what was the word? This is wickedness. And 2 Thessalonians says, verse 8, and then shall that wicked one be revealed. Now, brothers and sisters, what we're being told is that the 2 Thessalonians, chapter 2, is a companion prophecy to Zechariah, chapter 5. Question, why do you think that Zechariah talks about a woman and Thessalonians talks about a man? Well, it's simple, really, because you see, the woman of Zechariah chapter 5 is the whole system of religion that moves to the land of Shinar. But the man of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is the leader of the system, the very king priest himself who sits in that temple. Now, do you know that crucial to deciding the proper interpretation of the 2 Thessalonians is this? A couple of things. Firstly this, verse 7. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work, says the apostle. And yet he says in verse 8, then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth. Do you know, one of the strangest things about the prophecy of the man of sin, of the 2 Thessalonians, is Paul says, it's already starting now. You can feel it, the mystery of iniquity. He's coming soon. And yet this man of sin, shortly to be revealed after the days of the apostle, is somehow still there when Christ comes, isn't he? Because the record says the Lord shall destroy him with the spirit of his mouth. So the man of sin is there shortly after the apostolic era, but he's still there when Christ comes. The man of sin has lived for centuries. Which means, of course, that there can't be any one man at all. But a succession of men, all sitting in the same temple, and all succeeding to the same king priesthood, could be the same man of sin down through time, couldn't they? It's one of the identifying marks, you see. And the last mark is this. And I don't know if you've ever looked at this, but it is actually crucial to the prophecy, is where is the man of sin? Where is his temple? Where does he sit? Where is he revealed? Well, it says this, 2 Thessalonians, verse 6. And now ye know what withholdeth. Or again, verse 7. The mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now withholdeth or letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. Now you'll probably know that that old English word for letting, the same as the word withholding in the Greek, essentially means that there was some power restraining the manifestation of the man of sin. You won't see the man of sin, says the apostle, until he who lets is taken out of the way. Now the burning question of 2 Thessalonians 2 is, well, who or what was letting or stopping the man of sin from being revealed? And until you've discovered what that might be, then you've got no basis for interpreting who the man of sin is, or perhaps for that matter, where his temple might be. So let me show you what the early believers believed, brothers and sisters, at the time of the apostles and beyond, concerning this phrase in 2 Thessalonians, he who now letteth. Irenaeus, who writes in AD 185, by the way, when did the apostle John receive the book of Revelation? What year, approximately? Is AD 96, I certainly subscribe to the later date, AD 96. So AD 185 is less than 100 years later, not very long after. And this is what he said. He said, Daniel 2, looking forward to the end of the last kingdom, the 10 kings who shall then arise, among whom the kingdom of those men shall be partitioned, and upon whom the son of perdition shall come. Now, you know where that phrase comes from, son of perdition? That's 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. So when did they believe that the son of perdition would come? After the ten horns had invaded the Roman Empire, then the son of perdition would come. Here's another one, another writer. Tertullian, writing about the same time, says, only let him hold fast who now rules until he is out of the way, who can only be the Roman state, whose breaking apart and dispersal among 10 kings will produce the Antichrist, and then will the evil one be revealed. That's 2 Thessalonians, isn't it? The evil one being revealed. Then shall that wicked be revealed. Here's Tertullian again, writing on another occasion. This is an absolutely remarkable statement. He says, and there is another great necessity of praying for the emperors, even for the stability of the entire empire and for the affairs of the Roman state, because the greatest force threatening the whole world and threatening horrible calamities at the very end of the age, we know to be delayed by the continued existence of the Roman Empire. Therefore, we are unwilling to put it, that is, the prophecy, to the test, which is why we pray for the delay of the Antichrist by favouring the permanence of the Romans. Do you know what he's saying, brothers and sisters? He's saying that in those days, when they were under the power of pagan Rome, and pagan Rome persecuted the believers, that they prayed to God that pagan Rome might be preserved. Can you believe that? Pagan Rome was persecuting the believers. And they prayed that paganism might be preserved despite their persecution. Do you know why? Because they believed that if pagan Rome was ever taken out of the way, something far, far worse was about to happen. And that was the manifestation of the man of sin. If that restraining power ever goes, they said, the man of sin will come, and that's far worse. And they actually prayed for the preservation of the pagan Roman Empire as the restraining influence to continue. Isn't that remarkable? That's what they believed. That's exactly what they believed at that time. Now, two more. Moreover, the Antichrist was prophesied to come when the times of the Roman Empire have been completed, says Cyril of Jerusalem. And lastly, in John Chrysostom, it says, he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way, 2 Thessalonians. That is, when the Roman Empire is taken out of the way, then he shall come. And naturally, for as long as the fear of this empire lasts, no one will readily exalt himself. But when that is dissolved, he will attack the anarchy and endeavour to seize upon the government both of man and of God. And the early believers, brothers and sisters, they absolutely believed that he who now letteth was pagan Rome that was stopping the advent of the man of sin. They sincerely believed that for generations. So let me recapitulate then in terms of the significance of that and what that might cause us to think about concerning, well, where is the temple of the man of sin? Is it in Jerusalem? Or is it in Rome? Well, the man of sin is part of the continuum of the rival power of the seed of the serpent, which since Nimrod has already always had a rival temple. The man of sin is a development of the prophecy of the woman called Wickedness, who has a house built for her in the land of Shinar, and the land of Shinar is most certainly not Jerusalem, but that's where her house is. And the man of sin is parallel to the little horn and the false prophet of Daniel 7 and Revelation 19. And both of those are associated with the Roman Empire. And so we expect the basilica of the man of sin to be in Europe, where the little horn is and where the false prophet will be, since they're all parallel and synonymous terms. So the man of sin of this chapter was to be revealed when the restraining power was renewed. And the taking of his seat, therefore, in the temple of God is not one single futurist event that's going to take place at some mysterious, undetermined time in the future. The man of sin has been alive for centuries. We're told that in the chapter. And so the question of where he sits in his temple becomes an issue that we can and ought to be proved by means of historical fulfillment. If Paul was right and he said, when he's taken out of the way, a man of sin will be seen, and where will you see him? Why, sitting in his temple. Well, let me show you what happened, brothers and sisters, because it's absolutely remarkable how that prophecy was fulfilled. Quite remarkable, really. See, what happened was this. In AD 312, the Battle of Milvian Bridge occurred, and Constantine fought against the Emperor of Rome, Maxentius. Who won the battle? Answer, of course, Constantine. Constantine won. Maxentius, Emperor Maxentius, was defeated. His body was thrown into the Tiber. So AD 312 was a turning point, you see. And by the way, Maxentius was the last emperor of what? And the answer is pagan Rome. He who now letteth. And now that Constantine had come, and he was going to be the champion of Christianity itself, the restraining power of paganism was about to be removed. He who now letteth is going to be taken out of the way. Well, you'd never guess what happened, brothers and sisters. Hard on the heels of the victory of Constantine, he did this. In the very same year, he came to Rome after that battle, and he immediately donated the Lateran Palace on Montecelio and the adjoining land of the imperial house guard, known as Campus Lateranensis, and he gave it to the Bishop of Rome, Pope Melchiades, who took possession of the palace basilica. So what happened was this. Constantine arrived after the battle, and he said to the Bishop of Rome, he said, look, there's a lovely little palace here that's got a little temple inside it, a little basilica, where you could do whatever you do. Would you like that temple? And Melchiades said, that'd be very nice, thank you very much, yes, I'll have that. And Constantine said, well, not only that, but you notice alongside this temple, this basilica, the Lateran Palace, there's a great big block of land, which up to that time had been the land of the imperial horse guards. It was the barracks of the horse guards. Now, those horse guards were 2,000 of the most fierce soldiers in the Roman Empire, but they made one bad mistake. What they decided to do was to back Maxentius in the battle and not Constantine. And unfortunately, Maxentius lost. And when Constantine arrived in Rome, he came to those barracks and he wiped them out. He demolished the barracks of the Imperial Horse Guard, known as Campus Lateranensis, right alongside the Lateran Palace. And he said to the Bishop of Rome, he said, how about you have the temple, and since I'm going to be the champion of Christianity, why don't you think about building something even bigger and brighter and better on this big block of spare land next door, which I'd be prepared to give you as well. And remember, as we saw earlier on, in AD 313, Constantine was going to issue the Edict of Milan to grant freedom of religion to Christianity. The restraining power has now gone. Well, what happened was this. In that self-same year, AD 313, the Church Synod convened for the first time in the Lateran Palace to resolve the problem of the Donatus Schism. There was a problem in the Church, and the cardinals got together. So what do you have, brothers and sisters, when a group of cardinals get together? You have a pride of lions, you have a gaggle of geese, you have a cluster of cardinals. So the cardinals clustered together to have this Church Synod, but guess where they met for the first time? They met in the Lateran Palace, where there was a little temple. And that temple was given to the Bishop of Rome in the very year that he who lets was taken out of the way. And a man of sin was revealed in his temple to the year. Isn't that remarkable, brothers and sisters? And let me tell you what else happened. Because you see, in that year, when the Pope or the Bishop of Rome moved into the Lateran Palace, it became the official seat and residence of the popes for the next 1,000 years of history. They lived there in that house. Next 1,000 years. Isn't that absolutely remarkable? And what happened was that the construction of a new basilica started on that very same year, AD 313, right next to the Lateran Palace. And it didn't take very long, only took about 12 years. And in AD 324, we're told that the new basilica was completed and dedicated by the next Bishop of Rome, Pope Sylvester. And when he dedicated the place, he dedicated both the basilica and the palace, and he called them Domus Dei, the Temple of God. Within 10 years of the restraining power of pagan Rome being removed, there was a man of sin sitting in a temple in the land of Shinar. Interesting, isn't it, brothers and sisters? How remarkable 2 Thessalonians came to pass. One thing I can tell you, one thing I can promise, is when the man of sin did appear, he most certainly was not sitting in a temple in Jerusalem, because the temple in Jerusalem had been destroyed. But there's a new one here in the land of Shinar, built for him especially. Now, you might not know much about St. John Laterans, which is why I thought I'd mention a couple of things in the context of what St. John Laterans is. Our focus tends to be on the Vatican, but it sort of rewards a little bit of study to think about the significance of St. John Lateran in this context. The Basilica of St. John Lateran's is actually the cathedral of the Roman diocese, and therefore it's the Pope's own cathedral. In fact, shortly after Benedict became Pope, there was an article that said that the Pope has just taken possession of St. John Lateran's, which is his own personal cathedral, belonging to the Roman diocese of which he is the pastor. And by the way, you never guess how he took possession of St. John Lateran's. Pope Benedict has just taken possession of St. John Lateran's, was the report. Do you know how the pontiff takes possession of St. John Lateran's? Well, there's a very old stone chair, and there's a festival called the Festival or the Celebration of the Civilian. And how that works is the pontiff arrives into St. John Lateran's, and he takes his seat on the chair. And that symbolizes that he now is in possession of this temple that belongs to him. He takes a seat. It's the celebration of the civilian. It's the mark of the Pope's possession of that building. Isn't that interesting? And so, in fact, as the original Christian temple, St. John Lateran's is the first in importance and primacy amongst the five basilicas of Rome. In other words, it's more important than the Vatican. It's more important rather than St. Peter's. If you go to the middle of the front doors, they're quite large and they're bronze. And those bronze doors were taken from the Roman Forum where the Senate met. So if ever there was an evidence that this system has taken over the Roman system and is now Roman, or Romanism at the time of the end, or the Roman beast, it's the fact that the decisions made in this church are of equivalent authority and power to the Roman Senate that once met behind these same doors in the Roman Forum in ancient times. They're the front doors now to St. John Lateran's, the Pope's own temple. And at the heart and soul of St. John Lateran's, the central point is the cathedral, which is the seat from which the Roman pontiff makes his pronouncements. Now let me show you that particular seat. If you can see it right at the back there, the seat at the back, in the very heart of the temple of St. John Lateran's. And what happens is you come up the steps, you see, a set of steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and there's this beautiful white throne. Does that ring a bell? A beautiful white throne, elevated, that he comes and sits on. And when he sits on that seat and makes pronouncements ex cathedra from the chair, he's infallible. He's speaking with all the authority of the entire Roman Catholic system when he sits on that chair in that temple and makes his pontifical pronouncements. Oh, and let me show you something really spooky. Now, can you see up the top of the building, at the top, above the chair? If you keep rising, lifting your eyes, and you come right to the very top of the dome, can you see the head of a man at the very top with a halo around him, right at the very top? Well, let's zoom up, shall we, and let me show you that, because that's a mosaic of the face of Christ. Now, what's interesting about that mosaic is that this temple, St. John Lateran's, has been destroyed and rebuilt 5 times since the days of Constantine. So if you go and look at St. John Lateran's today, it's not the one that Constantine built, but guess what? That mosaic is. That mosaic in the temple of St. John Lateran's has been there since the day of Constantine and the dedication of the temple of God by the Pope in AD 324. And that mosaic, brothers and sisters, has looked down, gazed down upon every man of sin who's ever sat upon that chair down through time. The one who's been alive for centuries in the 2nd of Thessalonians chapter 2. Isn't that interesting? Like a complete continuum of time, this man of the seed of the serpent power in his rival temple. And next to the basilica is what's called the Scala Sancta, the holy staircase. Now, it's called the Scala Sancta, or sometimes the Scala Palati, because it's said that Constantine's mother transported Pilate's staircase from the Praetorian Guard in Jerusalem and took it stone by stone to Rome. And it's built right alongside St. John Lateran's. So it's a very holy staircase, you see, the holy staircase. In fact, you're not allowed to walk up that staircase. There's actually, I think, either walnut or cedar boards on the stairs, and you've got to shuffle up on your knees. You can't walk. You can only shuffle on your knees to demonstrate just how holy that staircase is. And guess what happens when you get to the top? When you get to the top of the staircase, there's this grill, and behind the grill is a mysterious darkness. And over the top of the grill it says, Sancta Sanctorum, the Holy of Holies. In fact, there's an inscription in the Latin that says, there is no place holier than this. And that place is so holy that only one man can go into that room and pray. Who's none other than the Roman pontiff. Do you remember another building where at the top there was a room where only the high priest alone could go to be by himself for the practicing of the Babylonian religions? Well, here it is, brothers and sisters, in Rome. This is it, the Sancta Sanctorum, the most holy place, into which the high priest alone can go. Does that sound suspiciously familiar to another system of worship that we know about, brothers and sisters? In fact, I've got a booklet from St. John Lateran's, collected at St. John Lateran's. And at the back of it, when talking about the Sancta Sanctorum, it says in that chamber, which you'll never see because only the Pope can go, but in that chamber it says, there's ancient relics. And not only are there ancient relics, but it says, there's ancient relics, it says, just like the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem. It's a rival system, brothers and sisters. It's always been a rival system. This is it. The temple of the seed of the serpent power at the time of the end. And quite frankly, brothers and sisters, the suggestion that the Pope of Rome would ever travel to Jerusalem to sit in a new temple built there by the Jews is preposterous, because for any Pope to travel to Jerusalem and to sit in a temple there would suggest or indicate what? That Rome was not the eternal city after all. That it was all pretension. No Pope will ever, ever make that admission. He's already got his own temple. In his own city. His own tower. And his own Holy of Holies. Well, that brings us back to our passage then, in terms of what the references say. And that's Zechariah chapter 6. Because there will be a temple in Jerusalem, and there will be a temple built there again, but it won't be for the man of sin. And it says expressly who's going to build it. And we're told in Zechariah chapter 6 and verse 12, the record says, the crown would come upon Joshua, verse 11, and speak unto him, says verse 12, saying, thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, behold, the man whose name is the branch, he shall grow up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord. Even he shall build the temple of the Lord, and he shall bear the glory and shall sit and rule upon his throne. He's a king. And he shall be a priest upon his throne. He's a priest. And the council of Shalom, the council of Salem, the council of peace shall be between them both. And when the temple in Jerusalem is rebuilt, brothers and sisters, it won't be so that some man of sin can come and sit there by arresting of prophecy with no sense of the framework in which that prophecy sits. It's going to be built by the man whose name is the branch, and he's going to build it so that he can sit in it for himself, brothers and sisters, because that temple of Zechariah 6 is going to be the temple of all the world, presided over by the king priest of the seed of the woman community. Is that not so? Do you know, over the top of St. John Lateran's, engraven in the stone, is a title that has been there from the earliest of times on each building. And the words are Sacrosanta Lateranensis Ecclesia Omnium Urbis et Orbis Ecclesiarum Mete Ecaput, which being translated from the Latin means Most Holy Lateran Church. Of all churches in the city and the world, the mother and the head. It's a rival system, brothers and sisters. But when Christ comes, he's going to build the real temple of the seed of the woman. And when he does, by the way, we're told this in a passage that we won't look at. But I'll just put it on screen so that we can read it. Have you ever seen that passage before, brothers and sisters? Isaiah chapter 2. You'll know that well. It says, it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. That's the final time of the elevation of the temple, of the true system of worship. The final successor to the tabernacle of Shem. And when that happens, says Jeremiah chapter 51, I'll punish Bel in Babylon and bring forth out of his mouth that which he hath swallowed up, and the nations shall not flow together anymore unto him. They flowed once to Babylon and to the king priest of that temple. They'll flow to Messiah in God's house in the age to come, is the promise of the Bible. Isn't it helpful, brothers and sisters, to have a framework on which to test prophetic events and prophetic ideas? And that man of sin, brothers and sisters, and precisely who he might be, will be, God willing, the subject of our first session after lunch.